I'm Deborah Owens, and welcome to Wealthy Radio. I'm especially excited about tonight's show. We open with a topic that's essential to making your shift to a wealth mindset, knowing your value and building your personal brand. Joining us tonight is New York Times best-selling author Lovie Ajayi, speaker and digital strategist who thrives at the intersection of comedy, technology, and activism. And in our second half, we'll hear from Sandra Davis, another phenomenal woman who is the creator of the premier financial coaching certification and founder of Sage Financial Solutions. And of course, we invite you to participate in tonight's discussion. Our phone lines are open. Join the conversation at 410-319-8888. You can also send us a tweet to @DeborahOwens with the hashtag Wealthy Radio Chat, or leave a message on the Deborah Owens Facebook page. All that and more in just a moment. Welcome, everybody, to Wealthy Radio. I'm Deborah Owens. And our next guest, well, I had the opportunity to meet her at the BET Leading Women's Conference. She gave a phenomenal workshop. She is a 14-year blogging veteran and the voice behind the widely respected blog Awesomely Lovie, where she displays her humor, wit, and wisdom, and of course her take on pop culture. Her blog, which has over 500,000 readers a month, inspired her debut book titled I'm Judging You, The Do Better Manual. It was released in September of 2016 and was an instant bestseller, landing on the New York Times list its first week. And if that is not enough, she is also driven to leave the world better than what she found it. She has the Red Pump Project, a nonprofit that raises awareness about the impact of HIV/AIDS on women and girls. And of course, she's a sought-after speaker. And she, I don't know, she's one of the funniest people I know, and I'm so excited to have her on Wealthy Radio. Lovie Ajayi, welcome to Wealthy Radio.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. You know, I wanted to start off by just asking you, it's interesting, I met you in person, and I felt like I already knew you because you really have a gift of putting on paper, your personality on paper. So talk to me a little bit about how, is that something that you were born with? Did you develop as you blogged over the years, or what happened?
I probably got better at it as I blogged over the years. I think I'm just a very transparent person. And I mean, people say I have a large personality and I'm able to write the way I speak. So it lets people connect to me.
It's true. So let's start at the beginning. I mean, did you go with the intent of becoming a just well-known blogger, or is it just something that developed over time?
It developed over time. None of this was strategic in that when I started blogging 14 years ago, blogging was not a career. And to become a writer, you have to be working for like the New York Times, or you have to be writing nonfiction or fiction like Terry McMillan and Toni Morrison. I didn't see myself as that. So when I started blogging, it was just because my friends peer pressured me into doing it while we were in college. And I started this blog, and I kept on going. And when I graduated from college in 2006, I deleted that blog and started what is now awesomelylovie.com. And it's, again, it wasn't intentional to, like, have this be a career, because I didn't even think it was possible. So for me, it was more of a, I just love doing this thing. I'm going to keep doing it. And I did. And cool things happened.
So let's talk about your sense of humor. And I got to tell you, I mean, I find myself just, you know, kind of just blurting out laughing when I'm reading what you put on your blog. And I can think of many terms that you use. So the question I have, and I'm sure our audience has, is have you always been this funny, or is it something that you developed? In fact, I looked at that is how the New York Times described you, is like the internet comedian, the next great internet comedian. So talk to us about how this humor developed over time.
I don't know. I've just been this person for a long time. I've been, like, I remember in high school, me and my group of friends cracking each other up in the lunchroom, and we never stopped. We basically, I think my humor is, one, based on the fact that I'm Nigerian also, because Nigerians are some of the funniest people on the face of the earth. Like, we're super blunt, we're super straightforward, but I'm also Yoruba, which is one of the main tribes in Nigeria, and Yoruba people are especially funny because our language is very metaphorical, so it allows us to describe things in stretch language. So I use all of that in my writing, and it comes out, and people love it, and if you ask me, like, where it came from, I honestly can't tell them. A lot of it has been innate. A lot of it has just been, I don't know.
So do you consider yourself...
It's probably gotten better over the years.
So do you... I mean, like, if you were to describe yourself, Lovey, would you describe yourself as a comedian, a satirist, or how would you describe yourself?
Ooh, that's a good one. I don't really describe myself as a comedian because I feel like it puts too much pressure on me to try to be funny. I don't necessarily even try to be funny. I just really observe things around me and put them down the way I see it. And then it happens to be funny. In fact, like, for a long time, I didn't even realize I was funny. Well, not funny on paper until probably in 2007, 2008, when people were like, oh my God, your blog is hilarious. And I was like, oh, so my blog is a humor blog. Okay, cool. Thanks for letting me know. So, yeah.
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you, when I started reading your blog, it really put me in the mind of a Whoopi Goldberg and also a Chris Rock, because you do have the gift of observation and you do convey it in a unique way. So my question to you is, do you think you'll come off of the page? So you've written this book, right? And now, you know, congratulations. I hear that Shonda Rhimes is going to create, you know, a project based on your book, Judging You. So
yeah. My
question to you is, do you feel like you're ready to come off the pages? I mean, I could see you like in your own one-woman show, you know, or I'm thinking of, you know, a Whoopi Goldberg, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like TV in some form is next. So Shonda Rhimes optioned my book to become a cable series. So we're currently developing that. And for me, I'm comfortable in front of the camera. I don't want to act. But I could totally do a talk show. I would love that, because my blog is essentially a talk show in blog format where I talk about all things pop culture, race, and whatever's happening in the world that I want to touch on. So I think it would be easy but because people do a lot of work on this, but I think it would be organic to take it to the next step. I'm thinking about doing a podcast, you know, so there's options.
Yeah, there is options. I just wonder, so she optioned the book, and I guess where I'm going with you, Lovey, are we going to see you on the tube too, or what are your thoughts? I mean,
one of the first things Shonda asked me was, okay, so basically the TV show is going to revolve around a character with my voice.
Right.
But I won't be playing that character because I'm not an actress, even though it's going to be essentially playing myself. But I don't really want to act. I think that would be for somebody else to bring to life on camera. Me on camera would be something non-scripted.
Yes. And yeah. I mean, that to me, that sounds exciting. But, you know, I was thinking, as opposed to you interviewing people, that, you know, you're kind of like a one-woman show yourself. Do you think you could do like maybe a special, like in a monologue or something? That is how I view you, as someone who, because So let me ask you something. Do you write extemporaneously, or do you write and edit, write or edit? Because when I read, I feel like, oh, man, she just sat down and boom, it came out that way.
Yeah, that's basically how I do it. I write and it comes out that way. And then what's funny is sometimes I'll go back to edit after just to be like, okay, fresh eyes. Okay, cool. But mostly I just write. I could do a one person thing because sometimes when I do talks, they're basically just me on stage talking for an hour. So I can do a one person thing in the way you've actually placed it, in the vein of talking about the world in 1 hour segments. Absolutely. I think it's something that I would love to play with.
I see an HBO special in your future. Our listener.
I'm claiming it.
I'm speaking it into existence. Let our listeners know, if you're just joining us, this is Wealthy Radio right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Of course, I'm Deborah Owens, your host, and my conversation right now is with Lovey Ajayi. You should, whoever doesn't know Lovey, I don't know, you must be living under a rock or something, but love her blog. If you've got questions, please give us a call, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. We're talking about how she built this phenomenal brand, and organically, not, you know, really strategically. Perhaps you're listening and you want to figure out, how do you find your voice? You know, what kind of suggestions would she give you if this is something that you think you might want to approach as well? Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Well, you know, the other thing I was reading about you just on background was the fact that Shonda Rhimes said you came on her radar from the recaps that you did on the show on Twitter, on Scandal, you know, Facebook. I think it was Twitter, though, because I follow you. And so, I mean, how did that feel? I mean, how did it come about that you started doing these recaps?
So Scandal started in 2012. And I started watching it basically as soon as it started, and I fell in love with it. I was like, this show is incredible. And at that point, whenever award shows come up, I would typically recap them the next day on my blog. So I'll recap the BET Awards, I'd recap the MTV Awards. So I was like, I should recap this show. So I started writing recaps of Scandal after every episode, and the recaps took on a life of their own. People started paying attention, and my site got bigger and bigger because whenever they'd watch Scandal, which always leaves you sliding off your chair at the end of every episode, people want to figure out, okay, what just happened? So my site became the place where the water cooler. It was the water cooler. I helped you figure out what happened because my recaps were detailed. I talked about theories, and the comments were epic. So then one day I was live tweeting Scandal, because I hadn't watched the live version. I was catching up a couple of days later, and Shonda Rhimes tweeted, "It's great staying up on Twitter right now to watch Lovey's timeline as she watches Scandal."
Oh my! So she called you out?
Yeah, right. Listen, I could have passed out right then. I was like, "What?" Like, the creator of Scandal is staying up late to watch me tweet her show, and it was then that I realized I was on her radar.
And it's sort of like the power of social media, Lovey. You know, it can seem overwhelming. And so what advice would you – so a couple of things. I mean, sort of like the gatekeepers are gone. I mean, if you want to put something out there and make something happen, you can. But then what advice would you give someone? I mean, do you think that the blog was more effective – just in terms of you really building that following, or was it using all of the different mediums from Twitter to Instagram? What are your thoughts there?
I was able to build my following because I used all the social platforms, but I think it was really important for me to have the blog because the thing is, even if you weren't on Facebook or on Instagram or on Twitter, you could always come back to my blog to hear what I thought about what's happening in the world. So having that space, and I think it also kind of set me apart from a lot of other writers because, you know, when you write for other websites, the sites get credit. So when you see an amazing piece that's on the New York Times website, you think, I saw this amazing piece on the New York Times, you might forget who even wrote it. People never got a chance to forget who wrote my stuff because it was on my site. So So that really helped me build my name. But I was always, even when I wasn't blogging, I was always putting up content. So I'd be on Facebook. My status might be my thoughts on what happened around something that's popular or buzzworthy. So I was always able to kind of keep people in the know on what I'm thinking.
And so what, I mean, so you started blogging, but what is your, talk to us just about your background. So you're blogging, I mean, you're not making any money of that. So like, girl, what was your, like, your real job? That's what I want to know.
So I was the marketing coordinator for a nonprofit in Chicago that taught other nonprofits how to tell their stories. So that was my background is in digital communications and marketing. So that helped. So I was doing that. I'd go to work 9 to 5 and come home and blog 7 to 10. So blogging was basically my second full-time job that wasn't paying me. And I wasn't going to do it full-time until I was forced to. Essentially, my job ended up laying me off because of budget issues. And it was kind of the universe pushing me to take the leap of faith I wasn't taking myself. So I started kind of paying more attention to this blog. And even though I was still like, I still need to find a job because how am I going to pay my bills?
Yeah.
I never got a chance to because it was kind of like the moment I finally realized, okay, you're supposed to be working for yourself. And yes, you can still be teaching digital market and digital communications and marketing and social media, but you can do that for yourself. So I basically kind of buckled down. I was like, all right, I'm going to do this thing by myself. And then cool things started happening.
Yeah, cool things started happening. But you know what, Lovey? I think, like, there are two pictures of people. Like, you see people, you know, on social media and, you know, they're on Instagram, they're on Twitter, and they've got a large following. But at the end of the day, many of them are not making a living at it, right? And so how did you make that shift? Like, yeah, you were forced into it, but what advice would you give someone who really wants to move from a side hustle to it being a main hustle? What advice would you give them? Like, what was your first real, when you knew you're like, yeah, I can do this?
First of all, the word hustle is key here. It is a hustle. In that you have to start thinking about yourself beyond, like I had to start thinking about myself as beyond a writer. I was a business. So understanding that my art was worth charging for. Because for a long time, I was thinking, oh, that blog is cute. I like it. It's just this hobby. And I wasn't charging or trying to make money from it because I didn't think it was monetizable. So making the shift of being like, no, like what you have here is something that people would pay for. So I started doing freelance writing, and then brands would come to me and say, hey, we'd love for you to work with us on this campaign because you have this audience that pays attention to you. And I was like, oh, okay, I can actually get paid for this for real. Cool. And it literally is a shift. You have to make the decision to be like, okay, I am a business. What I am doing here is worth being paid for.
And you know, one of the quotes that we posted just on some of the promos that we were doing is one of the things you said, when you accept less than you're worth, that's what people are going to keep offering you. Give us a sense of what did you mean by that? I mean, was there a point where you like knew that you should maybe charge more, but you were afraid to ask for what you felt like you were worth?
Yeah, I mean, being an artist, being a creative, people will want to negotiate you down constantly. People will always want to have you think that your work is not of value. So it was one of the lessons that I learned along the way of understanding that when you start accepting and saying yes to things that aren't of your value, people are going to keep bringing those things to you. Like, those are going to be what people are keep offering you because nobody's going to offer you champagne when they know you're going to take apple juice. And actually, I was really inspired by Nicki Minaj. She did this interview where she talked about how she no longer accepts pickle juice. And she tells a story of how she goes on a photo shoot that's supposed to be this luxury photo shoot. And she shows up and there's literally pickle juice at catering and like 3 pieces of clothing on the racks. And she walked away. And people were like, why'd you walk away? She was like, 'cause if I keep accepting pickle juice, they're going to keep giving me pickle juice. So she knows, so people know next time, don't bring that to her.
Yeah, so no. I totally agree. I mean, you know, one of my idioms is whatever you accept, you get more of, right? Because you're basically, you know, like a couple of things are going to happen. So if you speak somewhere, lovey, and then the first thing somebody, oh, you had lovey? Well, how much did she charge, right? So what, and they're going to tell them. And so then you're going to end up, you know, that is sort of what you're going to receive. So in that vein, at what point, I mean, how did you determine what you should charge? Give us like the inside story. What was your process of finally saying, I've hit a certain level, I have these followers, this is what I'm going to do? How'd you get help?
It's trial and error. You have to know what other people are charging around you. You have to know what your industry standards are. So it was trial and error of like, okay, I'm going to charge this. And then be like, ooh, that took me 15 hours to do. I basically got super underpaid for that. So basically trial and error for me, came down and doing some research. Also, I have a lot of friends who are bloggers, who are creatives, and we talk candidly with each other. So we'll tell each other how much we got charged or how much we got paid. And we'll say, well, this is how much you should ask for next time if they come to you. So having that community is important too. Being able to be transparent with your friends and with people who are technically your coworkers, and though you guys don't work for the same company, if we're in the same industry, we're technically kind of coworkers. So we should all, it's in our best interest that we all get paid well. Because if somebody's getting paid $500 for one thing and then somebody else is getting paid $10,000, it's a disservice if they're at the same level. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so you got to figure out the market and you got to do your research. Let me let our audience know. Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. If you're just joining us, my conversation in this first half is with Lovey Ajayi. We're talking about how she's been able to build this incredible brand. And what we're going to talk about next is I want to talk about your book. So did someone approach you to write a book, or based on the blogs, or talk to us a little bit about how that happened?
I had been blogging for a while, and I knew I wanted to write a book because I feel like I wanted somebody, people have something to hold on to. What's funny is I got my book idea pretty organically. I got it on August 4th, 2014 at like 6:56 p.m. Central Time, because I know this because on that day, I put this in quotation marks, the journalist plagiarized my work and took about three paragraphs of my work, dropped it in his with no credit, and I was upset about it. I was like, what? This is insane.
Ooh, so I basically, girl, you just went down the road. That sends me over the edge.
Yes. So I end up dragging this dude on social media, and then I dragged him up and down and around, like across platforms on my blog. I was like, this is ridiculous, because as a writer, all I have are my words. So it's important to me to protect them. So then he emails me and he's like, oh my gosh, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do that. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah.
So I tweeted, was there not a limited edition handbook that some of us got on how not to be terrible people? And literally in that, when I tweeted it, I was like, that's the book I need to write. I was like, that's the book I need to write. I got the idea instantly. And that's how I'm Judging You, the Do Better Manual came to be. A couple of months later, out of the blue, a book agent emailed me. It was like, I think you're brilliant. I'd love to represent you. I ended up signing with him. Then I told him my book idea, and he was like, oh, amazing, write the proposal. And I did, and a couple of months later I had my book deal.
So you had your book deal. So talk to us a little bit about what that's like. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people sometimes think that, you know, you write this book and then, you know, you're going to be everywhere and your publisher are going to make things happen. Talk to us a little bit about how you got on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, was it your publisher who made everything happen, or, you know, give us the real?
I was hell-bent on making sure this book was a success, because publishing is hard. Publishing and like the film industry are very similar in that whenever black people do well, we do well as exceptions, but when we do badly, they think it's the rule. So for me, I was like, this book cannot fail, because if it does, it makes it that much harder for somebody who's Black and woman to get a book deal.
Girl, so you care, like, oh, you're carrying us all on your shoulder. That's right.
I literally was like, this book has got to fly off the shelf. So I committed myself to making sure I did everything in my power to have my book be a success, because I knew it was bigger than me. So, you know, my publishers did do some work and provided some support, but I also activated my audience. So my audience had been with me for 13 years and had seen my journey and how I went from being full-time marketer to being a full-time just lovey. And who saw me go from Blogspot to WordPress, who saw me go from, oh my God, I'm so frustrated, nobody's paying attention, to, oh my goodness, oh, I'm on Oprah's Super Soul 100 list. My audience, I basically was like, I'm going to need your help to make this book fly. And they made it fly. They you know, the on my launch date, social media was painted judgy. Like, everyone posted covers of my book everywhere. People were able to see that, okay, I need to get this book if I had not heard about it. It literally was this massive campaign to make sure my book was everywhere. And it sold so well, and it still continues to sell well. And, yeah, I was able to really activate the group that had seen me grow, and then all the work that I had done for 13 years culminated to this moment of really having people believe in me and supporting me with their money.
You know, and I think that's great advice. You know, in fact, I love what you said, how you framed it, and that was you activated your audience. You know, because, and you asked for help. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, you were shy about, hey, I need you. You guys are reading my stuff now. I need you to write the book. So now you've got the Shonda Rhimes is about to write this series based on the character, right?
So we're in development. I'm actually doing a lot of the writing right now. Hopefully in a year, you guys will see a show about my book. Being optioned means that they have the exclusive right to turn it into a show. So
okay.
It doesn't guarantee that you'll see a show, but best case scenario, you'll see a show.
So that you know, I mean, that's got to be exciting for you, right? I mean, look at what you're learning. And my goodness, you're working with Shonda Rhimes. That's kind of scary.
It is a dream come true. Like, I basically got the queen of television on the, who said, I believe in your book so much that I'm going to want to turn this into a TV show. There's no bigger compliment for me.
Oh.
So it is definitely exciting, and I'm using it as basically a masterclass. It's like a private masterclass. I'm getting to see how television shows come to be, and I'm a student of television, because I love it. I watch so many shows, and I write about them, and I've always loved television and storytelling, so this is really cool.
Well, I got to tell you, it has been just really inspiring watching your growth and watching all of the success that you're having. And I know, you know, a lot more of your story because you share it. You are pretty transparent. So please let folks know, how can we support you? What do you need us to do now?
I would love for people to buy my book if they don't already have it. I'm Judging You, the Do Better Manual is available everywhere where books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iBooks. Yeah, getting the book is really important. And then, you know, just staying on top of my journey. I'm on social media at Lovey, L-U-V-V-I-E is my username on every social network.
Excellent. Well, Lovey, we appreciate your coming on Wealthy Radio, and we'll be watching you, girl.
And thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, folks, don't go anywhere, because coming up next, that was Lovey Ajayi. Definitely go get her book. But coming up next, we're going to talk with financial expert Sandra Davis, and we'll talk about top financial mistakes and how to avoid them. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Live your life. Hey, 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 hey. You steady chasing that big car, just live your life.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Deborah Owens. This is Wealthy Radio, and I'm really excited. I have this guest in studio, and I really don't need a written script for her, because what I would say is that I followed this woman from afar for a couple of years, and because she's doing some great stuff. And you guys know I love this whole wealth gap, closing the wealth gap, and you know I've been on this mission for financial empowerment, but so has she. But what's really interesting about her journey is it was kind of a journey that she was going in one direction but went with her heart. I mean, this woman went, got a master's in financial planning at Golden State University, and thought that she would go on to develop, I mean, to work with maybe high net worth clients, because that's why you become a CFP. But she went again with her heart, and she was instrumental in the development of the San Francisco Office of Financial Empowerment Smart Money Network. She is co-founder of Earns Work and Financial Coaching, and she's collaborated with a number of different organizations. And what many people don't know about her is she really has been the trailblazer of the financial coaching discipline, and has created one of the premier certifications for financial coaching. And the bottom line, that what I love about this woman is her heart, and that heart of wanting to help all peoples of income build wealth. But she puts it another way. She really wants to help the vulnerable, you know, the least of those, become financially capable. And so it's an honor to have Sandra Davis in studio with me. Thanks for coming in, Sandra.
Thank you for inviting me. I can't even tell you how excited I am to be in here with you. I know we were on the telephone last time, but it's really very different. This is awesome.
It is
very
different.
Excited to be
with
you.
Well, you know, and it's so interesting when I asked someone to introduce me to you, and she said, sure. And then you said, oh my gosh, you know, I've been following you. You're like my Shiro. And I'm like, what? What?
Yeah.
And so I do feel like we're kindred spirits, just in terms of the mission and what we like to do. So welcome back to Wealthy Radio, Sandra.
Thank you. I am thrilled to be here. And yes, I had been following you. I knew about all of your books. And, you know, I was a career changer in this field. And so you were a grown-up. You were like a trailblazer out doing your thing when I was just a baby in this field. And so, yeah, you were one of the women that I watched. And for me, the books that you had written were really about people taking their power and really having their personal power around their financial choices. And that's really what drives me. You know, that's what was a big deal for me. I made every financial mistake possible before I became a financial planner. So yeah, I have a master's degree now, but I have a master's degree in being broke from way before. a comedian said, I was so poor, we couldn't even have the other O and the R. I was poor. So, and that's what it felt like. And so, you know, I followed you, I watched what you did, and, you know, it really feels good to be able to do what my heart needs to do.
Yes, I want our audience to know you the way that I've come to know you. And so I'm so glad that you kind of took the veil off and shared with people. You may look at me, I'm Sandra Davis, I'm, you know, the founder of this Sage Money Solutions, but at the end of the day, I am you. Yeah. So let's talk about you a little bit. I'm interested in learning. Yeah, you made every financial mistake in the book, and that's what I want to talk to. That's what I want to talk about mm-hmm. this evening, mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. And again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. If you want some financial coaching, now's your chance. America's Wealth Coach, but actually, we have a woman who really knows how to coach around finances, and that's what she does. So we want you to join in this conversation. But I want to begin with this question, and that is, what took you on the path to want to go into the whole financial education, financial literacy space?
So I was in the nonprofit sector for years. I had been in the nonprofit sector for about 20 years, and I was watching people come back over and over again. I helped people get housing, you know, send their kids to college, get jobs. And what I was noticing was kind of this revolving door, right, that irrespective of what we could offer them, if they didn't get a grip on their personal financial choices, nothing would change. So you help folks get a job, you make more money, and what happens?
More money, more problems.
There you
right?
go. They spend more money. And so rather than finding this work, this very important work in the nonprofit sector as a pathway out of poverty, it kind of was perpetuating some of the same things that were really causing people distress. I knew nothing about money at that stage. I mean, literally nothing at that point. And I had a company doing management consulting for nonprofits, and I took a year off. And in that year is when it kind of came together about what I really needed to do. Now, mind you, I was so paranoid about math that when I went back to college, I didn't even go to college until I was in my 30s. I joined the Navy right out of at 17, so I didn't go to college until I was in my 30s. I was so afraid of math that I wouldn't even take the entrance exam.
But you know what? This is really interesting because I'm amazed at how often that story, that tape, goes on in people's heads, and sometimes it's planted in people's heads, right?
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
I went to a Catholic high school, so I took no higher level math. Mm-hmm. They put us in like administrative courses. Mm-hmm. And so I did. When I got to college, I really had like a phobia around math and you know.
And see, people think that means you can't deal with finance.
Right.
And there's just nothing further from the truth. You know, and so what happened is I decided that if I wanted to help other people, I had to first get my financial life straight.
Okay.
Every financial planner that I dealt with, I was at Golden Gate University in San Francisco. I was in the master's program. And I'm a veteran, so I got a lot of scholarships and those kinds of things to do that. But everybody was telling me, oh, well, you know, you're really going to have to make your living doing financial planning for high net worth folks. And then after you've secured your financial life, then you can do pro bono work and all that other stuff to help the people that you really want to serve, which is low and moderate income clients. And so I thought I would have to do that. I listened to them. I was a rookie in the field, didn't really know much. And then I got to volunteer at an organization, and EARN was that organization. At that time, they were doing what's called individual development accounts.
So what does EARN stand for?
It was Earned Asset Resource Network, but they've kind of shifted. Now, they actually do work all over the country on matched savings accounts. Now, they have a program where if you save $20 a month, they actually help you by matching and then also helping you kind of create a savings habit. But at that time, they were really trying to help people figure out how to live with their money differently in a different way. Same ultimate goal, but the idea was a little bit different back then. And so I started volunteering with them. And I was in school. I was doing my practicum to finish my master's in financial planning. And I created a volunteer program to take pro bono financial planners and do financial plans for low and moderate income clients. And it was an amazing program.
And so how did that work? So you're doing financial planning, and typically that's an advisory capacity. That's telling people what to do. How did you develop your interest in coaching, merging the coaching skills with that financial advice?
Well, Deborah, that's a very interesting question. So what I learned very quickly is that when it comes to our financial lives, people seldom do what you tell them to do, right? So most people know what to do. They know the basics. You know, if you spend less than you make, you know, put away something for a rainy day, try to make sure that you're saving for longer term goals, right? So most of us know that. But when you're battling multiple financial priorities, and quite frankly, we live in very interesting times, right? So when you're dealing with multiple financial priorities and you're in an economic environment that's not conducive to you saving, you know, it's hard to be broke and feel broke and think about saving.
Right.
It's hard to think about, you know, we were talking about earlier today about putting money away in a savings account for your children to go to college if you're trying to keep your electricity bill on. It's hard to keep your electricity bill paid. So it's hard to think about those things. So what happened for me is I was really fortunate to learn from some of the leaders in the financial planning profession about what wasn't working. And quite frankly, that's how I actually became a coach. I learned what was not working, and then I tried to figure out something else. And so I went to a school to learn about coaching. And the reason that coaching was so important is that it was client-focused, right? So it's not me telling you what you should or should not do. It's not me shaming, blaming, or judging you. Unlike, as much as I love Lovey, unlike the I'm judging you book, I am not judging you, right? Yeah. I'm a financial coach. That's what we avoid. So what that did for me was it gave me language to work with people in a way that was empowering for them. And you'll notice I specifically don't use the words to empower people because I don't believe it's possible to empower someone else. People have to own their power. And so I help them figure that out. I help them identify what matters most and then put their energy where their heart is. And their energy means their time, their money, basically, and their attention. And so that's really what happened. I learned to coach because, quite frankly, I was working with somebody, a financial planner, and she says, you know, I just can't get my client to live within her $50,000 a month budget. Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. And so I realized at that point it wasn't about the dollars.
It's never about the money. So let's talk about that then. It's never about the dollars. And talk to us a little bit about your experience with coaching and how you may feel like it is what it is, another avenue, or I guess the question I should ask, do you think coaching is more effective than advising?
Well, so I think it depends, right? Okay. The standard answer in this field is always it depends. I believe that there's this continuum, right? People always say that financial literacy, everybody needs financial literacy, and that's true. But knowing better does not equal doing better.
That's right.
And so you can know what to do. Like, I mean, I know that I shouldn't eat those 4 coconut macaroons that I bought today, right? But chances of me not eating them slim to none.
Since I bought them,
right?
But you had a friend.
But I know, so I'll give her 2, right?
Out.
Exactly. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And so, you know, the idea was that financial literacy, financial education is crucial. But knowing better doesn't equal doing better. But the fact is, you cannot do better if you don't know better. Right?
Yes.
And so that's where the coaching comes in.
Knowledge is not power.
Exactly right.
Knowledge correctly applied is
exactly.
power. And so I truly believe that accountability and support, and that you put yourself in the environment that's going to help you win, and you know what some of your, self-knowledge, right?
Right.
And so I guess my question to you now, and let me just let our listeners know, if you're just joining us, I'm Deborah Owens on Wealthy Radio, and we're in our second half. In our first half, we were talking with Lovey Ajayi about her book, Judging You, and just how she built her brand and knowing your value. And now my conversation is with Sandra Davis. She is with Sage Solutions. You should follow her on Twitter @SageMoney, Sandra Davis. And we're talking about her financial coaching practice. But what I want to talk about tonight really is some of the financial mistakes. And one of the things that Sandra shared was that she's made every financial mistake in the book. And we'd love to hear from you. You know, do you have some financial mistakes that you want to share? I know nobody ever wants to share their mistakes, but I really feel like you can't change what you do not acknowledge. So give us a call, 410-319-8888. Or perhaps you have a financial mistake and you're trying to figure out how to get out of it. Well, you know, we love doing that in our What Would Deborah Do segments. But now I've got Teamwork Makes the Dream Work. So give us a call at 410-319-8888. So let's talk about what do you consider to be your worst financial mistake?
Oh, my goodness. So there are 3 things, right, that I'd like to kind of put them all together. So the 3 things is not knowing who I am around money, right? I did not know until much later in life that I am a spender. I said it. My name is Sandra. I'm a spender.
Okay.
Right? So I did not know that about myself. And so I didn't understand that every time I said yes to one thing, I was saying no to something else, mm-hmm. right? So I didn't really understand how that worked. I knew that I wasn't supposed to spend more than I made, and I had credit. So, you know, there's that, right? So I remember, I actually remember when I got my very first credit card, and my son's godmother, she looked at me, she says, "You're going to regret this day." And she was right. I did come to regret that day because I just, you know, I did not understand that once you get in a habit of using credit in a way to consume things that, you know, they might be needs. I have no judgment about whether they're needs or wants. But basically, if I'm using credit, that means I don't have the cash.
Right. That means you can't afford it.
By definition,
By definition,
I can't afford it.
Absolutely.
And so the access to credit allowed me to make a choice that was harmful in the long run. If I had not had it, I probably would have figured something else out. I'm not saying that I wouldn't have gotten the thing, but I probably would have figured out how to cut corners someplace else or something else. So that was one of the first ones. The second one was really not knowing what I wanted. I had no clue how to set a financial goal. I never really thought about, you know, what was my financial legacy going to look like? I had a son. You know, I never thought about how what I did with my money every day affected him. Even though I know for a fact that every financial decision that you ever make is shaped by what you know and believe about money. And what we know and believe about money comes from the people who were our primary
caretakers. So what did you know and believe about money that made those, that influenced the decisions that you made?
Yeah, so I have an amazing mother. My mother worked really, really hard. And she also spent what she made, right? She was a single mom raising four kids in San Francisco in the 60s. I just told y'all how old I am. Okay, so no, I'm just kidding. All right, it's all right.
Only gets better.
But what she did was she taught me that when you have it, spend it. If you want it, get it. I had everything that I could ever want as a kid. And it was a little bit easier for me than it was for my brothers. Things were tighter when, you know, it was just them. And then as I came along, she was making more money and I got everything that I wanted. So I never really had to struggle, you know. And then she was such an entrepreneur, as before anybody I know in my community, before anybody even knew what an entrepreneur was, right? She needed more money. She'd take on another job. And she was a serial entrepreneur, and I just never really understood.
What kind of jobs did she do?
Oh, my goodness. My mother sold clothes. My mother was a domestic for a very wealthy family in San Francisco. If they were doing dinner parties, she would do that. But she was just brilliant, you know, and never really got a chance to do all of the things she was capable of. My mother could sell sand in the desert. The woman she's an amazing, even now, an amazing saleswoman. She could get you to buy anything. You can be freezing cold, she'll sell you ice cubes, you know. And so I kind of learned that, you know, if you need more money, you get another job.
Yes.
So at one point in my life, I actually had three jobs. I had worked my way into a financial position where I had to work like that just to sustain my family. And so those are the kind of habits that I learned. She didn't say, now, hey, sweetheart, I want you to work your behind off and be tired and broke like I am. But that's what her behavior taught
yes,
me.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? And so, you know, so funny now because when she talks to me about money now, she'll say, oh, if I just listened to what you said. I said, yeah, Mom, if I had just listened to what I said.
Well, yeah.
Right?
But, you know, so that's sort of like, you know, what you just described really, Sandra, was your money story.
Exactly.
And I feel like that is such an important part of really connecting and understanding yourself and your beliefs and you know, your attitudes around money, right? Right? And so how's that changed? So if you were to look at your 20-year-old self and
yes.
you were to look at yourself now, what's changed around your beliefs?
Yeah, so now I won't say that my beliefs have changed, right? I truly believe that if I do good work in the world, the universe or God or however you define that, I do believe a supreme being, so however you define that, will take care of me, right? So that is my core money belief. That's my core value. I don't think that beliefs change. I think that how I interpret the beliefs change. So for instance, now I have a financial plan. Now I have a monthly spending and saving plan. Now I pay myself first, right? So that's kind of the last piece when we talk about, you know, when you ask me to prepare for what are the biggest mistakes, you know, not knowing who you are, not knowing what you want, and then not knowing what you do, right? And so now I know what I do. I know the financial choices that I make. And for me, I really know what's important to me. So I know what my goals are, and I know when what I'm doing is moving me toward my goal or away from it.
Yeah, that alignment is so important. Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. I hope you're enjoying this conversation. I certainly am. Sandra Davis is a financial coach and a consultant, and she speaks all over the country. In fact, she is from Oakland, California, and she happens to be here. I kidnapped her. She's speaking at an event tomorrow along with myself, and I thought it would be great to have this conversation. The phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. We're talking about, you know, decisions that we've made about money, you know, how we all have to learn about money. But I think the most important thing you really said, Sandra, was, and I do believe this with all my heart, is that the issue really comes down to deciding what you really want, right?
Right.
And it's not until then that you can. So what happens if you don't know what you want, then you'll do what is in front of you right now because you haven't decided what you really want. You know, you've coached a lot of people. Was there any kind of situation that you have? Not that you're divulging anything, but I don't want you to divulge anything personal, because I do know coaching is confidential. But could you give us an example of how coaching maybe changed someone's life and their views and attitudes around money?
Certainly. So that happens often.
Okay.
And normally what that is I guess rather than say it changed it, I would say that the word you used earlier, alignment, right? So the person in the coaching conversation came to understand what they were really trying to do with money, right? So often people will behave in a way with money that they're not really sure what they're doing. And so I was working with a client who would often have emergencies in Ann Taylor. And
what's an emergency? Oh, so her emergency money was going to Ann Taylor.
Exactly right. Okay. Exactly right. So she would save and she would get excited about having some savings, and then she would have an emergency in Ann Taylor and feel compelled to spend her emergency fund inside of Ann Taylor. And so what that came out to be was that she had a sense of pride in being able to shop there.
Really?
Yes.
So it was the store, and how did you get underneath that?
Well, so she was, you know, from a pretty poor immigrant family. She was the first in her family to go to college. She was the first in she was the person in her family to actually become a physician. Now, she was working in a hospital to do, you know, they have these loan repayment programs for student loans, whereas if you work in a community-based hospital,
yes,
right? So
forgiven.
She was doing that. So she wasn't making a lot of money. Right. So she's in this loan forgiveness program where her wages as a physician were kept low for them to do this loan repayment thing. So she's living the doctor lifestyle without the doctor income because she wanted to present this successful picture for her family. And so shopping at Ann Taylor gave her that sense of, you know, I'm not exactly,
yeah.
and I'm not a fraud, right? I can pay for this and I can afford this. And it had her in constant distress. I mean, she was taking extra shifts. She was working like a mad woman, trying to manage these student loans, trying to manage living in the San Francisco Bay Area, which, as you can imagine, is not, you know, it's probably about the same here, but it's really expensive.
No, it's a little bit more expensive.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the median income right now, what they're saying is low income in the San Francisco Bay Area is $103,000 a year. Is considered low income in a couple of the communities in San Francisco. So she was in that kind of environment. And so for her, being able to unpack what was really going on, and we actually did it with a role play, a visioning and then a role play, where she had to think about what was going on with her when she made the purchase. So having people look at her like she didn't deserve to be there when she walked in the door was one thing. The second thing was being able to walk up to the counter and whip out this credit card, even knowing what kind of stress, and she knew when she pulled it out what kind of stress she was going to feel later. But being able to do that and have the people behind the counter look at her differently now that she's making this major purchase, that was what was going on for her.
Well, you know what is interesting? As you were saying that, I was just thinking about how our whole marketing machine really supports having that feeling of you belong.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at, you know, the whole luxury and the designer, mm-hmm, labeling and all of that,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it making you fit in and feel like you belong, right? Mm-hmm. And when you can't afford something like that, you really do feel less than.
And so much so, when you look at, you know, I'm a music lover, you look at music videos, and you know, people don't realize that stuff's rented. You know, people don't realize that, you know, a lot of people are not living the lifestyle that it looks like. But, you know, you see that and then you attach a value to that, you know. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of that. So I think, you know, just kind of to make sure that I'm clear, really knowing who you are, right? Wrapping your head around what is your money personality without shame, without abusing yourself. What's going on?
So how did you change? How did she? So once she, I often say you cannot change what you do not, mm-hmm. not acknowledge. So mm-hmm. you went through this role play. And what was her aha moment?
Her aha moment was when she went into the store and she went to buy something and her credit card was declined. And the shame that she felt by having all of this stuff sitting on the counter and having the clerk look at her in a way that reflected back how she thought of herself. So she thought of herself as always poor. She thought of herself as not good enough. She thought of herself in negative ways. And so putting all of these purchases on the counter and then having them rejected had this clerk looking back at her with this judgment that she was feeling for herself.
Wow, this was a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I can't believe it. We're already out of time. But Sandra, please let folks know how they can follow you and get some of your wonderful wisdom on social media and contact you for any other interest that they may have in what we discussed this evening.
Well, first, thank you. I loved being here. I'm Sage Money on Twitter and Facebook. Sage Money is my Facebook page. And people can also go to our website, sagefinancialsolutions.org, and they can find us there.
Excellent. Well, folks, that's going to do it for tonight's broadcast. Many thanks to Lovie Ajayi. I hope you love that conversation. Don't forget to go out and get her book, Judging You. Yes, I'm Judging You. And Sandra Davis, please go to her website, Sage Financial Solutions, and follow her on Twitter at Sage Money. A big shout out to the Wealthy Radio team, senior producer Samantha McCoy, engineer Andre Melton, and of course, a big thank you to my partner, husband, and best friend, Terry Owens. Next up, get ready for the best in Latin jazz music with Fiesta Musical. That's going to do it for me this evening, folks. If you want to follow us and know what's coming on our upcoming shows, go to DeborahOwens.com and, of course, sign up for our free newsletter. Thanks so much for listening. Have a prosperous week, everybody, and good night.